Judiciary Committee will come to order. We're coming to order right at 1:30 on the afternoon of Monday, May 19th, 2012. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Pascan is here, Vice Chair Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French. Don't know where the other two members are, but people are busy. I know Finance is having hearings. I think Senator Coghill will be here in a little bit. I will take a break and announce his presence when he arrives. We have two bills up today, SB 172, and the other one is SB 198. We're going to hear SB 172 first. I'll just say before we start that this is the time of year when the Judiciary Committee earns its pay. Last Friday, we heard a life and death bill. Today, this is another life and death bill. They're both tricky areas of the law. It takes some concentration to get up to speed on the legal issues presented by them, and I know I spent about 2.5 hours yesterday in my office reading through the bill packet on SB 172, and I had to go back over and over and over to read both the bill and the definitions and then the legal analysis we've gotten from Ledge Legal and from private attorney in Anchorage. It's a tricky area, and I'm going to personally be cautious in this area. But I welcome this bill sponsor to the table and have him come up. Senator Dyson, thank you for coming down here today. And put yourself on the record, and the floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for hearing this bill. I'm Fred Dyson, senator from Eagle River area, and with me is my chief of staff, Chuck Kopp. The purpose of this bill is to provide for the protection of patients' rights to prevent a physician from issuing a do-not-resuscitate order on a patient without the consent of the patient or if the patient lacks capacity. And the phrase lacks capacity is a term of art in law, as I understand it. It means they're competent to make the decisions. Or without the express consent of the authorized agent of the patient, or if no one's available to be authorized to speak and patient lacks capacity with the concurrence of a second physician. 2004, the legislature drafted current AS 1352, and I might say that your colleague, Senator McGuire, worked hugely on these issues, and I worked with her some. You probably saw my name mentioned in the Duke Law Review there. Most was to do with advanced life directives, but I think in that time frame there, maybe 2006, we corrected some of the issues that were highlighted there in the Duke Law Review. But if you read it, the language in the Health Care Decisions Act in its entirety, it supports an interpretation of the chapter which allows a patient or the patient's authorized representative to prevent a physician from issuing a DNR order. But as you saw in both the Law Review and the opinion from Terry Bannister, that there's still ambiguities in the chapter. And as the chairman said, you got to read it all and carefully to kind of get the whole package, and it was our intention to clear up those ambiguities. So that's what we're after today. And the statutes that Senator McGuire and others worked on during that period are pretty good, I thought. The Duke Law Review says that my interpretation of what it says is that the clear intention of the legislature wasn't completely represented in how it got written, and there's ambiguities there. And they use the term, I think, infused with loopholes. Maybe that's right. But it was 2006 that some of those issues about guardianship and surrogates and agents got cleared up. This stuff was not something we were looking for in our ambitions and goals for this legislative session. Another senator referred Marjorie and Mervyn Mullins to us for assistance concerning a disagreement over the health care decisions at a very large and very good Anchorage hospital. As I understand Marjorie Mullins' situation, her husband had terminal brain cancer and was expected to something like 12, 16 months, some trajectory like that after diagnosis, and the family faced it very well, and apparently with a good deal of grace. Her husband, Mervyn Mullins, was a patient at a good hospital in Anchorage. And our understanding is the staff there did a good job of dealing with the patient and the family. The crisis came when, as Mr. Mullins was at the hospital for some medical care, not directly, as I understand it, related to the brain cancer. His wife came to visit him, found that their DNR, do not resuscitate order, had been placed on her husband without his permission or concurrence or hers, and she is a legal surrogate, durable power of attorney, and that the medical staff refused to remove the do not resuscitate order from her husband. And this is all hearsay. This is what she told me. Mrs. Mullins called and told us her situation. She asked we contact the hospital to see if we could help. We contact the hospital, started this long process that's got us before you here today. We believe at the time there were simple misunderstandings, and we asked Mr. Lamoureux, the chief executive officer, I believe. I get the titles mixed up. And he and I had a pleasant phone call. He forwarded to me the hospital's policy on medical ethics, and these situations seemed fine to me. It seemed in concert with other hospitals around. We began to examine the law. We asked Ledge Legal to do it and look at Chapter 13 or Title 13, Chapter 52. We asked if the Health Care Decisions Act was clear that a patient with capacity had the authority to make a do not resuscitate order ineffective.
Senator, nice to meet you. Hang on 1 second. I need to let the record reflect that Senator Coghill joined us several minutes ago, and we've also been joined by Senator Olson.
Wow. Legal responded, that was Terry Bannister, and she did some excellent work for us. It's part of your packet. Now, summary, she stated the law is fairly clear that a doctor has a right to issue a do not resuscitate order, but is limited by the decision of the patient or the patient's authorized representative, and that that agent or the patient can revoke a DNR order. However, she said there are ambiguities in the chapter that could result in other interpretations, which we assumed had happened in this case, in this hospital we're talking about. So we started working on this bill, and we saw it as a reviser's bill to take out the ambiguities, put it together in a more logical order, and not to change the law, but to make it clear the original intent of the law. We sent copies to a couple of the executive staff at the hospital, seeking their input. I think that was late December or January, and so on. Another incident happened with Ms. Mullins. On a cold winter day, early this winter, she brought her husband, Mervin, to the hospital and was told that her husband would not be admitted unless the do not resuscitate order was in effect. Marjorie called our office, asked for help. She was desperate. I called the physician who I thought was in charge. I thought he was chief medical officer. Now I understand he's a chief operating officer, but a man I know and respect. And my understanding is that conversation, he told me that because this DNR was in the patient's record, he could not admit them without that DNR being in effect. And I told him I did not understand the law that way, and that another physician or the patient could revoke that, but nonetheless, in my view, his responsibility would treat the patient who presented himself at the facility in a medically appropriate way. A few minutes later, seemed less than an hour, maybe less than a half hour, Marjorie called, said her husband had admitted, was a very relieved person. And I assumed the issue was done with. But after this bill was heard in Senate Hess, all of a sudden, some people from this institution were here in the building, probably made contact with some of you, certainly with the bill's co-sponsors, and presenting some pretty significant disagreements with where they perceived we were going. We, out of that, came a meeting with Mr. Kopp and I and the chief operating officer and two doctors, one of whom's here in the room with us today, and we had a long discussion. I assumed we were going to be able to work out most of it, narrow down where it was. The doctors that were there, my understanding of their comment was, no, a patient should not be able to revoke a DNR order, and that the medical professionals were in the best position to use judgment about whether that was appropriate or not. When we tried to say that we understood that patients' rights trump the physicians in terms of the DNR, one of the doctors, at least I thought, said, well, then the existing law is inappropriate and should be changed. But anyways, as a result of that conversation, we made several revisions to the SB 172, which are now is before you as a sponsor substitute, that we thought took care of some quite valid suggestions they have. But a recent letter from their attorney seems to me they take exception to even the accommodations. So when, as you hear testimony today, I'd ask you to keep in mind this legislation does not require a doctor to do anything harmful to the patient. And the legislation recognizes that consent of the patient should be obtained when the patient has capacity and is able to understand the risks. You can imagine a doctor might say, you're really frail. If we do CPR on you, we'll have to break some ribs. You know, it's always a risk. And I can imagine the patient saying, hey, it's a no-loss deal for me, doc. If I'm going to die anyways, you break a couple of ribs but get me going again, I'm good with that. So I see there's two questions for you before you today. Does the current law, as it exists, give a patient with capacity the right to make a do not resuscitate order ineffective?
When you say ineffective, do you mean?
Null and void. It supersedes the DNR. If your answer is yes to that, then your question before you should be, does our bill here today help clarify the ambiguities? If you decide that the current law does not give a patient a right to make the DNR ineffective, then the question before you and us is, what's appropriate? What is indeed the will of the legislature about that single issue? And if you agree with us and what we think is a clear intention of the legislature when this stuff was written, if you think we should have a patient's rights be supersede that of the doctor, but the law doesn't make that clear. Then we need to answer the question, does our bill get to the right policy and modify the section adequately? All right, I think I just told you everything I need to. With your permission, I'd like to have my chief of staff run through the bill for you, and I think it would be appropriate for you to ask questions anywhere in his testimony if you choose. Your choice.
Thank you, Senator Dyson. We do need to get the CS formally before us. The / D delta. I'd accept a motion to that effect.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lukowski has moved that we take up /D. Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, the CS is before us. Mr. Kopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the Judiciary Committee, I'd like to just proceed with the section analysis for the committee substitute. Will and I can also talk about any changes along the way. Section 1 amends AS 1352-045, deals with withholding or withdrawing life-sustaining procedures. I did give the committee members a copy of the entire statute for your reference there, too. A do not resuscitate order does not prevent a health care institution or facility from providing life-sustaining procedures to the patient. So just clarifies that if you're under a DNR, it doesn't prevent the facility from providing those life-sustaining procedures. Section 2, dealing with
counsel.
Senator Wilkowski is forming this question, let me just say I probably spent a half an hour just on this section alone yesterday. And Senator Wilkowski's initial I'm just going to jump in and say he's probably having the same mental struggle I had, which is I had to read that three times before I finally said, I think I understand that. But later on, you know, in my afternoon, I realized I didn't understand them because they have some specific legal definitions. So it's you know, this bill is not an easy bill to get.
Senator Wilkowski. You took the words out of my mouth.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Can you slow it, maybe explain sure. section? So it's a healthcare institution may not interpret a do not resuscitate order as preventing them. So basically you're saying they can disregard a do not resuscitate order. Is that what we're saying?
No. This is dealing with the issue of life-sustaining procedures, and it was brought to us by the attention of legislative legal to more thoroughly clarify in the statute. Life-sustaining procedures is different than a do not resuscitate order. Life-sustaining procedures is any procedure necessary to sustain life. And all this says is that a healthcare facility does not have to interpret a DNR as preventing them from giving life-saving medications. For instance, you may have several other things you're dealing with besides the primary thing that's taking your life. And depending on what they've worked out with the surrogate, with the patient, with the doctor, the hospital doesn't have to say, because you're under a DNR, no life-sustaining procedures can be given to you. That is something that we believe the dialogue should be open for. This simply clarifies that a DNR does not prevent that discussion from occurring.
So, Wilkowski and then Senator Pascoe.
The hospital.
Yeah, and so basically, so you a do not resuscitate order. So, can you could you give me an example? So, you're basically saying there's two different things going on here. Someone says do not resuscitate me, but there's some other issue going on with them. Someone's in a coma. On the operating table, they're about to die, but they've got another condition. Maybe you could give me an example to help me understand in my mind a little better.
Well, sure. Generally, a do not resuscitate order is only issued to patients with a qualifying condition. A qualifying condition is someone under the law that has permanent unconsciousness or has a terminal condition that they're, outside of a miraculous recovery, they're not going to come out of. So. Permanent unconscious and terminal. So you have a patient with a qualifying condition, a physician issues a do not resuscitate order, which is their authority to do so. Where life-sustaining procedures comes in is in the advanced health care directives. Either at that point, a patient can declare beforehand that they would like these procedures to come into play. If that patient is unconscious, then a surrogate could comment on what life-sustaining procedures. A life-sustaining procedure does not overrule a DNR order. It merely says that we would like these, to occur. If those aren't declared, and if there is no surrogate, the law already states the healthcare facilities that there is process set up for them to make those decisions if someone is not represented.
So, a good example might be artificial feeding, and because that. Throat cancer or whatever, So while they're still competent and want to stay alive, then just because they're being fed through a tube, or assisted breathing, doesn't mean that the DNR doesn't mean that can't continue or be applied. Same way with pain control stuff, and catheters, maybe dialysis, and so on. So the DNR doesn't prohibit the hospital from doing whatever they believe is appropriate for that patient.
Thank you.
Let's proceed.
Section 2.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Pascoe had a question. Yeah. I beg your pardon.
I think it's important at this time that the committee get a better understanding of a distinction between an individual instruction or a health care decision and a do not resuscitate order, and what distinctions are there in those types of what's the distinction?
Senator Pascoe through the chair. An individual instruction comes from the individual, and in the definition section in Title 13, that's almost exactly what it says. It's coming straight from you. If you have capacity, you're giving an individual instruction. A healthcare decision can be broader. It can be stated in your advanced directive that you made while you had capacity. A healthcare decision can be made by a surrogate who is representing you, and a healthcare decision can be given by you yourself. But an individual instruction is coming from the individual.
Okay.
Does that help a little bit?
No, no, it absolutely. And the, you know, that gives to the individual the choice, so to speak, of accepting or declining types of health care.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And what I'm trying to do is better understand how you're trying to affect something on the other side of the equation, which is a do not resuscitate order that doesn't come from, in other words, it is not an individual instruction and it is not a health care directive.
Yes, Senator Pascan, through the chair. I would like to let legal comment on this. They, in their opinion, a do not resuscitate order is a health care decision. And they stated that in their December 30th memo, which is in your packet. I think it's because there can be confusion between the order going out from the physician and the patient's response to make it ineffective or not. The physician has the authority to issue the order, and as we believe and as we'll show, the statutory authority for the patient having the right to make it ineffective if they disagree. But they both work together. The physician has the authority to issue the DNR, and the patient has the authority to make it ineffective. Those are both health care decisions.
We'll continue on. In other words, I see a clear distinction between the individual's ability to decline the advice of a provider. The question is that if a provider enters a do not resuscitate order, what capacity does the individual have at that point?
Exactly the question that brings us before you. And you can imagine, I mean, the whole section there on the advanced care directives, stuff that Senator McGuire put in, that's you decide if you want to donate organs, all those kind of things. But you might have done that 20 years ago. So the law provides that when you get down there to the end of it, or all of a sudden you're in a traumatic injury or stuff, you can change that because the world may have changed in your view of it in that time. Everything in those steps can be negated or changed by a patient with capacity or their surrogate. Absolutely necessary, you know, because the person knows a lot more and is a different situation. But indeed, those are valuable things, and minus anything else, you know, a surrogate, a family member, or patient capacity, those are the documents and that guide the health care givers. You know, that's the default if indeed there's no other responsible person there. But our and you see in the Duke thing, discussions about guardianship and surrogates and, you know, so on and so forth. Most of that's been taken care of. The single issue that really is before us here is on the DNR.
If I may, Mr. Chair. In other words, it's one thing for a patient to say, I choose not to follow recommended care. I think it's another thing to say, I want a doctor to have to do something that the doctor doesn't recommend. And so that's where I'm trying to figure
absolutely
that affirmative transfer. In other words, it seems to be the inverse of a declination, to where the patient now has an affirmation that can be imposed.
Yeah, that's right. But I think most doctors and institutions will tell you that if a patient goes into arrest, always they'll give CPR or try to jump start him. You know, one of the doctors that we consulted with said probably 1,000 times I have given CPR to a patient of mine who had a cardiac arrest on the operating table. You know, it's just what we do. It's always a presumption of life, and give it a shot. And that is not at all outside of what traditional medical practice and ethics has been for at least 1,000. When was Hippocrates?
Hippocratic Oath.
Hippocratic Oath.
Yeah, Hippocratic Oath. I was trying to think of the dude's name. Anyways, but you clearly.
I don't think his name was Hippocrate. Pretty sure it was Hippocrates, but we'll see.
We don't have unlimited amounts of time, so I'm going to ask you to speed along in your sectional. We have many, many doctors who've taken time out of their lives to testify. We also have Senator Olson here. I want to get on the record. I know he's busy up in finance, so please proceed.
Section 2 amends obligations of health care providers, institutions, and facilities. And this section states that a health care provider may not decline to comply with a do not resuscitate order for reasons of conscience if the order is consistent with the provisions of AS 1352, which is what the law currently states, even if we did not amend it. Legal basically just help us restate it, maybe a little more clear, that a health care provider, if there's a DNR order on you, they have to go by that. Nor can a health care provider, health care institution, or facility decline to comply with an individual instruction or a health care decision that requests that a do not resuscitate order be made ineffective, except as provided by AS 1352-030H, and that is the section that says that a physician may decline to comply if they see that a surrogate decision maker is not acting within the best interests, values, or wishes of the patient. They can overrule a surrogate in that regard, which we agree with, and that is the current law. Section. Additionally, the change that you have in the committee substitute reflects the narrow focus of the bill to protect patients from being subject to a DNR order against their consent, and we believe it is consistent with current statutory language. And I made a copy for the Judiciary Committee members. I highlighted in yellow about 10 sections, which make it fairly clear on the consent issue. But if I just may direct your attention for the sake of time, I know that you can read this at your leisure. But if you go to 1352-100 under capacity, there is a it says an individual who is a qualified patient, including an individual for whom a physician has issued a do not resuscitate order, has the right to make a decision regarding the use of cardiopulmonary resuscitation and other life-sustaining procedures as long as the individual is able to make the decision. We feel that's pretty clear. There's about 10 other statements in there that make it, we feel, almost equally clear that it's very difficult to get around overruling a patient's authority with respect to a do-not-resuscitate order that's been placed on them. Under immunities there, just below that, it says a health care provider or institution that acts in good faith and in accordance with generally accepted health care standards applicable to the health care.
Are you in the statute or in the bill?
I'm in the bill. I'm just...
Oh, you're in the bill.
What section?
I apologize. I'm sorry. I thought I gave the quote. It's 1352-100.
Right.
And that was F that I just read.
F?
1352-100. Let me go back to it again and make sure. 1352-100C, I'm sorry. 1352-100C is the section I just read.
Right, and that's not in the bill. That's in the statutes.
Yeah, but it's in reference to being consistent with current statutory language.
I understand. I'm just wanting to make sure the record is crystal clear, sure, that you're reading from a statute, not from reading from the bill. Very good. Please proceed.
Thank you, Senator. 1352-100F, which I just quoted, read actually from the statute. And then, again, in immunities, 1352-080A6B specifically comments that when dealing with discipline or civil or criminal liability for unprofessional conduct, it says that you will not be subject to that if the conduct is a result of causing or participating in providing cardiopulmonary resuscitation or other life-sustaining procedures because an individual has made a do-not-resuscitate order ineffective under AS 1352-065F or another provision of this chapter. Members of the Judiciary Committee, there are about 7 or 8 other sections that I've highlighted in yellow here that similarly strongly support the ability of a patient to not be subject to a do-not-resuscitate order against their will. And under the effect of this chapter, it says that nothing in this chapter can be construed to, and as a final note, I'll read it right for you here. It's 1352-120. In the absence of evidence to the contrary of the patient's intent, this chapter establishes a presumption in favor of life consistent with the best interest of the patient. And Under capacity 1352-100A, it says, this chapter does not affect the right of an individual to make health care decisions while having capacity to make health care decisions. So briefly, that's why we feel this amendment is consistent with current law. Going down to Section 3, Obligations of Health Care Providers, Institutions, and Facilities, states a health care provider, health care institution, or facility may not decline to comply with an individual instruction or health care decision that requests that a do not resuscitate order be made ineffective. And again, except as provided in 1352-030H, was the exception for surrogate decision makers that are not acting in the best wishes, interests, or values of the patient. Section 4 amends the current 1352-065A do not resuscitate protocol and identification requirements, and this says that a physician may issue a do not resuscitate order for a patient of the physician only as provided in this section. And here we ask legal to draw together for us all the things from the law that could be found in one place that would deal with do not resuscitate orders, when they could be done, and when it should not be done. Section 5 amends 1352-065B to state that the protocol adopted by DHSS for withholding of CPR by healthcare providers and institutions must comply with this section. Section 6 amends 1352-065, again the do not resuscitate protocol, by adding new subsections. And the first one, G, states a physician may not issue a DNR order without the express consent of the patient. If the patient has capacity and is 18 years or older, consent may also be provided by an advanced health care directive or by a person authorized to make health care decisions for the patient. It says further that a physician may issue a do not resuscitate order without the express consent required above. If patient does not have capacity, no one is authorized to make health care decisions for the patient, and one of three things: the patient has advanced health care directive, which indicates a patient wants a DNR order, or the patient has an advanced directive, which is silent about issuance of a do not resuscitate order, and another physician occurs in the decision to issue a do not resuscitate order. And then finally, if the patient does not have an advanced health care directive and another physician concurs in the decision to issue a do not resuscitate order. Subsection I states that a physician shall revoke a DNR order for a patient if, one, the DNR order violates G of this section, above under consent. Two, patient has capacity and requests the do not resuscitate order be revoked. Three, the patient does not have capacity. Patient does not have an advanced health care directive that indicates the patient wants a do not resuscitate order. And a person authorized to make a health care decision for the patient requests the revocation of the do not resuscitate order. Or finally, the patient is under 18 years of age and a parent or guardian of patient requests that the do not resuscitate order be revoked. The last amendment in this section states that a physician may revoke a DNR order issued by another physician for a patient if the physician has a physician-patient relationship with the client. Terry Bannister from Legal will be better to comment on this, but I believe everything that you've just seen there is either directly stated in the current law or can be inferred. Section 7 amends the section on immunities to replace a citation to a subsection that is repealed by this bill, which is the Do Not Resuscitate Protocol in 1352-065. Section 8 amends 1352-300, which is the optional form that this state has in statute that healthcare facilities are told they can come up with their own form as long as it complies with Title 13, Chapter 52. The new section added was life-sustaining procedures, instructions for healthcare end-of-life decisions, which gives patients the opportunity to accept or decline life-sustaining procedures or identify specific life-sustaining procedures they wish to receive. We have further clarified this at the request of Legal, and it was the opinion of our legal department that life-sustaining procedures wasn't adequately addressed in the advanced directive form, so that was added. Finally, under Section 9, amended definitions, the definition of healthcare decision was expanded to include a direction relating to the provision of CPR or other resuscitative measures. Section 10 repeals the old Do Not Resuscitate Protocol in 065F, which currently addresses how DNR orders are made ineffective. And Section 11 adds a provision to indicate how do not resuscitate orders made before the bill's effective date are to be treated in light of the bill.
Now, with your permission, we'd like to have Marge Mullins, I believe, is at LIO in Anchorage.
Ms. Mullins is on the line. Ms. Mullins, can you hear me? Marjorie Mullins?
Tell her to push the...
She's not on? Oh, they're not? They're offline?
Yeah.
Okay. She's not online right now.
Right. And
we do have Senator Olson here. Maybe we should make time for him to come and testify. Senator Olson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to testify on this bill that I feel fairly strongly about. And I'll put it in the perspective that I have as a physician, as a person that's gone to law school, and as a legislator as well. As you go back, and what I see here is that there's been a fair amount of fuzzy boundaries that are out there. There's, you know, blurring between this over that, and the issue of some of the definitions that are there. And I guess it ultimately leads to confusion. What I see this bill does, it clears up, doesn't necessarily change what's out there, but it clears up some of the confusion so that we as people can go ahead and understand what our basic rights are. And the way I look at it is that the person that should be the most in charge of his health care is the person themselves, the patient that is out there. It's very disturbing to me when I hear that there are people coming to the hospital, as was put forth by the bill's sponsor, and they are afraid that something that either they agreed to or something that they have changed their mind on related to a do not resuscitate order is being overruled so that their wishes are not being complied with. And that's why I have the problem with the way the old bill has it, that there is a matter of interpretation as to who's out there, what physician is there, what the institution policies are, what the code of ethics put down by a national organization have that overrules or has some way of saying that I want all stops being pulled out. I don't care what I said a year ago. I don't care what I said 20 years ago. But by God, things have changed. I've got a new grandkid. I've got things on my mind I want to take care of. I want all stuff taken. I want all stops taken out so that I have a chance of coming back. Now, fully realize that I come from the perspective that I have had lots of people that have gone down on me and have not been able to come back no matter what we wanted or how hard we tried. And there have been people that we brought back. And so as you look at those numbers that are there, I want to make sure that you're fully aware of that my concern is that the patient's wishes are adhered to. As we look at what's going on, I just want to make sure that that is what's there, and I think that's what this bill does. And so with that, I'm open for any questions that you may have.
Questions for Senator Olson. Senator Pasfan.
And again, I'm looking at 100C of the statutes, and it's it says an individual who is a qualified patient has a right to make a decision regarding use of cardiopulmonary resuscitation and other life-sustaining procedures. And so my assumption is, and this is why you're the perfect person to ask maybe, is my assumption is that you get to a point where cardiopulmonary resuscitation and other life-sustaining procedures have failed and you have a do not resuscitate in effect. At that instant, what controls? In other words, cardiopulmonary resuscitation has failed. Other life-sustaining procedures have failed. The doctor has a DNR in effect. How can that be changed at that instant? That's what I'm struggling with.
Okay, I'm not sure that it can be changed. I think you're asking an almost impossible question. Here's the way I look at CPR. If somebody goes down on me, unless there's a specific reason, and like they don't want to be resuscitated, it has to be respected. But as hard as I try, I am not God. I am not the one that determines whether they're going to be coming back or not. I can only do what I can with what I have available. Whether, if you have a laryngoscope, you can tube somebody. If you have CPR, somebody else there to help you, you can try and resuscitate somebody. But you can only go within the limits. And I've been in situations where I've had very limited resources at my disposal. But as far as going back to your specific question, that's a very difficult one to go ahead and answer at this point.
Just one follow-up. So, you know, and I clearly understand that the patient, under current law, has the right to decline cardiopulmonary resuscitation and has the right to decline other life-sustaining procedures. And again, what I'm struggling with is taking that, going beyond the right of a patient to decline life-sustaining procedures, and now saying, I have the right to change a doctor's recommendation. That's where I'm struggling.
I think the patient should always have the right to go ahead and overrule whatever doctor's in charge there, because doctors, like anybody else, have got other ideas on their mind as what they want to do.
Let me ask a question on that. If a patient can overrule a doctor, can a patient demand a certain medicine?
Sure, they can demand it. It's up to the doctor to go ahead and say whether he's going to succumb to that demand or not. I mean, if a good example is whether you want generic drugs or treat, or whether you want a brand name drug.
What if they want acupuncture? Can a patient demand acupuncture from a doctor?
He can certainly make that demand.
Can you compel the doctor to perform acupuncture?
Oh no, not if a doctor's not acupuncture trained. I would be very hesitant to start putting needles into anybody at anywhere.
Let me get more specific. Can a patient compel a doctor to perform CPR?
I would say that if a person goes down, it's the moral obligation of those people that are around to try and assist whoever goes down, assuming it's a cardiac arrest or whatever else, for them to try and come to his aid.
But if in the doctor's judgment CPR is medically ineffective, can a patient still compel that doctor to perform CPR?
I would say that's a very difficult question to answer. And I would tend to say that I know there's a fair amount of hesitancy by physicians. It's happened to me up on the finance committee. We had a senator go down once.
I've almost had a cardiac arrest in front of the finance committee, so I totally understand.
A colleague of ours went down once, and TV was obviously on the situation. And I realized that I didn't have any malpractice insurance, so I was very, very concerned about what was going to happen, because it didn't look like we were going to have a good outcome. And sure enough, one of the colleagues that was there said, you know, this guy's pulseless. So it was a very serious situation, and a lot of things went through my mind. However, we had a good outcome in the end. And it was I felt it was obligatory on my part to get there, because people knew who I was. People knew what my training was. And I went past the point of looking at the guy and saying, you know, how many bills of mine have you killed in your committee? So we had a good outcome. So you ask a question that's there, but I would say that within, you know, because public funds have been expended to try and go ahead and educate that person. Public funds have been expended in many cases for equipment to be there and available, like we have here with the devices that are on the walls.
We do have the Anchorage LIO back online. Further questions for Senator Olson?
No, thank you very much for listening to this.
Your testimony is very well received by the committee. Thank you for making yourself available. Ms. Mullins, can you hear me now?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you very well. Go ahead and give us your name and affiliation, if any, and give us your testimony.
My name is Margaret, M-A-R-G-R-E-T, middle initial A, Mullins, M-U-L-L-I-N-S. I appear before you to speak on behalf of my husband, Mervyn Eugene Mullins, a brilliant civil engineer who recently was awarded the Corps of Engineers Alaska District Hall of Fame, only one of 19 who's ever received that. He also received the Bronze Order of the DeFlory Award, a national award for his engineering brilliance That was in August of just last year, and received the Commander's Award. I also speak on behalf of myself, who with him suffered through what we endured because of this poor, or I'm told poor, DMI language in the current bill. And I speak on behalf of every citizen of the United States who values life and considers the termination of their own life and when only God's decision and not man's. This is my testimony. I urge you to hang tight because the violations against my husband and I were many and grievous and long. Forgive me if I'm not always clear because of tears. This is a very hard testimony. He passed away only on the 29th of February. On 2 January 2010, my husband, Mervyn Mullins Jr., a brilliant civil engineer, was diagnosed by Dr. Linda Smith at Providence Hospital's emergency room as having a stage 3 glioblastoma multiforme, GBM for short, tumor in his left temporal lobe near his speech center. It was giving him increasing speech aphasia on his opposite side of his body. His right and left leg were diminishing in use. GBM is extremely aggressive, I was told, and according to this doctor's experience, death occurred at stage 3, the stage he was now in. The diagnosing physician, the brain surgeon, the chemotherapist, the radiologist all said that surgery, chemo, and radiation would only be palliative, meaning they would only extend the mother's life for a short time, perhaps 2 to 4 months rather than 2 to 4 weeks. Also, doctors and or their staff urged us to sign a DNR order. It explained much in detail that full code care might include heart compression, which might do damage to nerves like breaking ribs or puncturing lungs, leaving those, quote, little remaining time one of much pain, thus, quote, poor quality of life, end quote. Mervyn and I thanked them for their experience, but relied on our faith in God, and Mervyn repeatedly confirmed that DNRs are against our faith. We believe every effort should be made to sustain life, and if that failed, God was indeed taking the believer home. But the attempt should at least be made, because any extra time received therefrom was divinely granted for God's plan and his purposes for that life, down to the last minute, to be fulfilled. We also explained that poor quality of life was not a consideration for us, because only God knew what could be done to a suffering person's life, through that person, and in the midst of it, even because of the pain and suffering and disability. We trusted God no matter what. We also told the physicians that the great physician was on the job, and that with all respect, we did not believe the doctor's death pronouncements of 2 to 4 months of life for Merv. Merv was additionally physically, mentally, and emotionally strong, enduring, and balanced. I'd taken good care of him. One doctor said that he'd seen an extremely rare case where GBM payments had lasted 8 months. Patients had lasted 8 months. Thus, we should not expect longer than that from Merv, and quite frankly, he said, be prepared for 2 to 4, that's much more likely. Mervyn and I had personally seen and been involved in 3 life restoration faith situations. First, my older brother received God's restorative miraculous power after a terrible car accident. His doctors told me not to fly down to the States to where he was, for he had manifold injuries, 7 of which would each individually cause his death during the night. Before I could arrive there, flying down from Alaska, the doctors insisted, just tell us where to send his body. We'll get it to you. They urged me to sign a DNR order as his next of kin. I refused. I flew down and prayed for him and stood by him. He made it through that night. He was alive when I got there the next morning. He was healed of a broken neck the first morning as I was there. In the next 10 days, all the other major problems had dissolved with no surgery done on any of them. He still lives a full life. Second, Mary and I had seen God's resurrection power in the case of an aunt. I flew down to pray for her after a doctor said she was brain dead. a heavy smoker. She hadn't had enough oxygen to her brain during surgery for a massive heart attack, which split a main artery open several inches. They wanted to unplug her from the life support. 5 days after surgery, her brain was test confirming the brain dead diagnosis. I arrived from Alaska and went in to visit her. After prayer and while singing praise to God, she squeezed my hand. I excitedly reported it to the nurses who called the doctors, who wrote it off as only reflexes. On a second visit to her after prayer, she followed me with her eyes on the long and the short of stories that in 4 steps, God did what the doctor said was impossible. She fully recovered all speech and mental and physical ability except for shortness of breath, and she lived a full life for 10 more years after that. Merv and I had also personally seen God's gift of grace to a small baby that doctors had said had died in the womb. One Friday morning, an hour-long sonogram detected no heartbeat or movement from the baby. The mother's doctor urged a DNC. After a second sonogram on a different machine produced the same lifeless result. But the young faithful mother refused the DNC, hoping for God's intervention. That night, we prayed for her at our small prayer and Bible study group. When she went back to her doctor on Monday, the baby was breathing, moving, heartbeating, and was born naturally, with no physical, mental, or emotional detriments to date. Mervyn and I thus have discussed DNR several more times after the doctor's request, adamant request, that Merv allow a DNR order. Merv immovably, to the end, opposed DNR, as did I. Brain surgery at Anchorage's Providence Hospital is followed by radiation and chemo, all of the standard of care recommended for Merv. MRIs followed all that, which showed that 2/3 of the tumor still remained. We kept in faith and stayed in worshipful prayer. Months later, an MRI showed that God had reduced the tumor by another 1/3. Only 1/3 of it remained, plus the tentacles of it. It's like a sea anemone, and the tentacles cannot be removed. The doctor said trying to remove them would be like trying to remove chocolate from a marble cake without hurting the vanilla. And the tentacles are too thin to show on an MRI. But instead of progressively deteriorating, as the doctors had predicted, Merv began driving. He even went back to work for several months and bicycled to work. In November of 2010, another MRI showed that the tumor was possibly growing again. In January of 2010, we flew to Cedar Sinai Hospital in L.A., where instead of doing a couple GBM operations here, like the last few surgeons, they did that many a week, thus were more experienced. They were able to remove all the GBM that showed on the MRI, except for the tendrils. We returned to Anchorage Providence Hospital under Cedar Sinai's oversight, and Providence gave Merv follow-up treatment, Tamoxifen chemotherapy. Actually, it's not chemotherapy, it does not allow the human body to create new blood cells. Thus, a tumor trying to grow can't form new blood cells to feed its new growth. Thus, the Tamoxifen was focused on slowing the growth of the tumor, not killing it, as chemo, as is chemo's game focus. Again, a grim prognosis was made that even with the Tamoxifen, 2 to 4 months, possibly 6 months, would remain for Mervyn. Again, Mervyn was asked by Providence doctors to consider DNR. He refused for the same faith and experience backed reasons. In May of last year, 2010, Merv began to have unbearable pain in his shoulders. We thought it was from lifting cans of roofing materials to the roof. And in June, Merv collapsed after showering. He spent 10 days at Providence where they discovered a possible spread of GBM to his cervical spine that was never proven, never fully ascertained. It was a guess because all other tests eliminated other things. And his MRI showed he'd had a small stroke, one easily recoverable from, which he did. During this visit, social workers and other staff hospitals again deluged us to sign a DNR. More than one, 5, 6, 7 people came in asking, are you sure you don't want to sign a DNR? We refused to sign the form for the same reasons as before. Merv during that hospitalization was not turned regularly as bedridden patients should be to avoid bed sores. and trying to get aides and nurses to come and change him when he'd soiled himself often took hours before he got that care. I complained about the lack of dignity given him in not relieving him quickly when soiled and taking a long time to come and get and help me get him onto a bedside commode. Once I waited 2 hours for him to answer the bell. I had gotten him on by myself. I called when he was done, and it took another hour and a half before someone came to get him off the commode. I was furious and complained to everybody and came into them asking them to get me a supervisor so I could tell them. No one took note. Supposedly, in my mind, looking back, because Merv was dying anyway. I did not know then what I do now and will shortly share with you. I complained about the lack of dignity and not relieving him quickly and so and take a long time to come and help. But the attitude seemed to be that he was last on the list of those needing care because GBM is consistently terminal. So why bother? Give other patients the main time. I have been getting him up for most of the day with a few naps and making sure he turned during the night to prevent bed sores when at home. But once hospitalized, the whole ball of his right foot began to redden and swollen. I asked the nurses to have a doctor check it out, but it never was. Before falling in the shower, he'd been walking. He was in a wheelchair and bedridden after being released, even though his speech returned. Shortly thereafter, Merv became so weak. After release from the hospital, he became so weak he could no longer help me support his weight as I shifted him from the wheelchair to the car for appointments and outings. He was checked into the hospital where I again repeatedly tried to get doctors to check out his now very swollen heel, but to no avail. Once I was able to find an assisted living place that would let me stay with Merv to care for him and would have staff there to help transfer him to and from my car as needed, Dr. Michael Smith signed the hospital discharge papers. Several staff, including doctors, nurses, and even chaplains at Providence, and including Mary Beth at Palliative Care, had during those 4 days come to Merv's room to try and urge us to sign the DNR. It was a repeated assault to sign a DNR. I, with every visit, got angrier and angrier and told them, stop coming. You won't change our mind. It's against our faith. When we refused Mary Beth became particularly aggressive and angry at us, saying that we were accusing me of making poor decisions for my husband. But my husband had speech aphasia and could not speak for himself. But I knew clearly what his will was. She was very self-righteous and very nasty to me. And she would not accept no for an answer and kept beating us that Merv really needed to sign a DNR. Her visit was followed by Dr. Michael Smith, who did the same, and he lost his temper when we refused. He angrily said it wasn't fair to Merv to have him suffer from saving attempts and to be forced to live a poor quality of life. We told him that choice was not the doctor's to make and that damage to Merv was not a surety, and even if life-saving measures were taken and did result in pain, that God still had things to do in Merv's and my life or in other lives around us, or he still had things to do here through Merv. Dr. Smith grew more angry and was yelling at us even, trying to force Merv to agree to DNR. Merv held his gun and refused me backing him up on this. Dr. Smith left, still angry. We kept asking about signing out of the hospital. It was about noon. We wanted to make a long trip to Delta and wanted to get on the road before dark. The roads were icy and bad. But the staff said Dr. Smith hadn't yet signed up Merv's discharge papers. 4, 5, 6 o'clock came, no discharge papers. Dr. Smith, after checking all, Jane finally signed the discharge papers that evening. I realized when handed the discharge permission that no doctor had yet looked at Mervyn's foot. I found a young man in Nurse's Aid and asked him to find Dr. Michael Smith and tell him that care for Mervyn's foot had been missed and that last year's swollen leg had meant a blood clot. It had been dissolved after a couple months of Levonox injected nightly into Mervyn's stomach, But it had been a serious swelling and then taken care of could have caused Merv's death. have the young man explain that to the doctor. I asked the young man to explain that to the doctor. He was gone for a while, and when he returned a bit later, he said that Dr. Smith had told him, we're not treating any sore foot. He's dying anyway.
Ms. Mullins, I am so sorry, and I grieve with your loss, and all I can say is I wish I had more time, and we're a little short of time.
Okay, so let me wrap this up in 2 sentences,
yes,
if
please.
I may.
Yes, please.
I will send you a written thing of all of this, please.
We will make
not
it part of the record.
Final things on this bill till you get it.
We will
but
make
I would
it.
Like to say that the DNR was consistently put back on MERV's record even after Mark Jackson personally met with me and gave me a letter indicating it had been removed. It kept appearing on MERV's record despite all of our complaints. So patients do not have the right of Providence to rescind a doctor's order. MERV died because the night before, no one came in his room and changed him. No one came in and turned him to relieve the collection of gunk in his throat. No one came in and gave him the meds the doctors had ordered to help him breathe every 4 hours. In a 12-hour period, he did not once get that medicine that should have been given every 4 hours. I believe he was murdered by neglect. And because of the DNR, because of the DNR attitude that no life is worth much more once they see that it's a fatal prognosis. I urge you guys to make this bill clear that this issue is not taken out of the hands of citizens and individuals. No doctor has the right to say, my husband does not have the right to live. Thank you. I am going to, as soon as I can, get this fax out and get it to you. The problem is I have a Mac, and how to print it out is something my husband does for me.
Ma'am, you...
Even upside down to, don't know how to get it from my computer to there. If I have to retype it on a PC, I will, but I will get it to you as soon as possible. You have to hear this whole thing. It's so ugly what happened in Providence Hospital. Providence Hospital's ethics board told me this law gave them the right to declare DNR over our wishes. They also said the hospital had the right to use their own services and materials however they wanted, regardless of patient faith or desire. There's so much more to this testimony. It's too bad you can't give me more time because this is absolutely crucial to what you're trying to decide. How can you make a good decision without giving me more time to hear what's going on there? I don't believe my case is unique. I just believe many people just be quiet and shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, the doctors have the right. They do not. I'm vocal. You need to hear this vocality.
Yes, ma'am. And we've given you a fair amount of time, and I recognize that there's more information that you have that we will consider. You can leave a statement with the LIO in any form, and they will transmit it to us. I'll make absolutely sure that every single member of the committee gets that and reads whatever you send. But we have 8 other people lined up to testify. They have valid points of view as well, and I'm sorry I can't give you as much time as you'd like, but I just can't. And again, we grieve at the loss of your husband, and thank you so much for coming out to testify today. We do have several other folks who want to testify. Let's turn to the room now. We have Stephen Rust here. Dr. Stephen Rust is here. And perhaps we should turn to him. If you'd like to come forward, Dr. Rust, I have a letter that was written to you from Robert Dixon on the 7th of March. I've read that and the follow-up letter written on the 8th of March. Go ahead and put yourself on the record and give us your testimony.
Yes. Hi, my name is Stephen Thomas Rust. I'm a physician, a board in internal medicine, geriatrics, as well as palliative care. I've been in active practice for the last 24 years and frequently deal with end-of-life issues and have intimate knowledge about Mr. and Mrs. Mullins' situation. And I'd like to thank the committee for allowing me to testify. I'll be briefer. Also say that I'm here to testify in opposition to CSSB 172. And what I would like to do is make a very short statement and just general principles, and then kind of open for questions that you might have, and hopefully it will be clear. I do believe that some of the information that was hearsay information that Senator Dyson received was probably not entirely correct, and but that is probably not cogent to today's discussion. The current unamended Alaska Healthcare Decision Act protects a person's rights, their autonomy, to consent or decline any medical procedure or treatment. And that basically is sacred in that a person's body belongs to them. This is my body. It belongs to me. You don't do anything to me without my permission. And I believe that I speak for the entire medical community when we strongly support a person's right to have control over their own body and what is done to them or for them. The current medical practice that in Alaska, and certainly where I work, is the statute is strong, the medical practice and statute is strongly biased towards life at currently. In doubt, if a person's medical condition, if their history is not clear, if their personal goals of care and individual beliefs, which are all very important, are unknown, we apply CPR. That is the given. We do that. Right now, a patient is protected in that any physician caring for a patient, and normally in a hospital there's at least one or two or three physicians involved. If any physician currently, under current statute, thinks that a person should have CPR applied to them, then it's done. It takes dissent or assent of one person in the entire group in order to say, yes, this is a reasonable approach to take. I have doubts. Let's do this. That being said, CPR is applied to people for all practical purposes who have died from something. It's an extreme measure. It's a violent act. Those who have undergone CPR, those who have witnessed CPR, understand that it is a violent act. And it's not something, it's not like giving an antibiotic or getting a catheter or do something. This is a violent act. And contrary to popular belief, it's not a panacea. In certain subsets and people, it's a very, very viable option. We do it. Given all takers, somewhere about 17% of people that arrest in a hospital survive to discharge after having CPR. And
Doctor, I should interrupt you because you've begun talking about CPR, but one of the things that I don't think we got on the record was that that's what a do not resuscitate order is exactly about.
Correct.
It's about correct. That one procedure.
Correct.
CPR.
Correct.
It doesn't cover 100 or 10 or even 5 different procedures. A do not resuscitate order, I'm reading from the statute definition 1352.390, subsection 12. DNR means a directive from a licensed physician that emergency cardiopulmonary resuscitation should not be administered to a qualified patient. That's what it means. So
correct.
Go ahead.
Correct. So rather than speak in negative, decline, it's double negatives, it's easier just to say apply CPR, and if that's okay with the committee. You know, right now, I mean, the physician community values life on a de facto basis. Our job is to save people, to rescue people, to cure and heal people to the best of our abilities. There are, however, times when medical procedures become ineffective and ill-advised, and separating out CPR from any other medical procedure, to me, and if I can speak frankly, seems a little bit ludicrous to say all of the procedures, yes, you have rights and responsibilities and use your best medical judgment. However, in a CPR case, another medical procedure, you cannot decline for matters of conscience, you cannot decline because of medical expertise. And that being said, it seems, I know what the intent is, but the intended intent won't be achieved through this bill. So I think that being said, with Mrs. Mullins and Mr. Mullins, who I had the opportunity to get to know very well, and actually had a very good relationship with Mrs. Mullins. Dr. Smith, Linda Smith, who diagnosed him, we all had a very, very good relationship with Mrs. Mullins. She's very, very sad. She's very, very angry. and her husband was her best friend and life partner, and she's, as I think you could tell from her testimony. That being said, when Providence, and I can speak as a physician would never fail to admit a patient to the hospital because they didn't want to have a DNR order. That is just not going to happen. And the other point as far as when Mrs. Mullins was talking about the DNR order, I believe she's referencing something called a Comfort One, which is not part of this, that which basically is the only way that EMS personnel are not obligated to perform CPR on a patient who is dying. And so that's what she was talking about, and not specifically the in-hospital policy. So I think with that being said, I would entertain questions that you might have. It's a very complex bill.
Questions for Dr. Rust? I guess I'll just say, in reading through the two letters we got from Mr. Dixon, March 7th, March 8th, the aspect that troubled me the most about the bill was the potential of finding yourself in a place where a physician is more or less ordered or feels compelled to provide care that he or she feels is not medically appropriate. That's my concern. And I thought Mr. Dixon's letter laid that out very, very precisely, both on the March 7th and March 8th letters. So that's just my reaction to them. Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, one thing is that as far as if a patient says, I do not, first of all, only 20% of people have advanced directives. I have part of one. I don't even have the whole thing, and I deal with this all the time. If a patient said, I do not want CPR, then a physician is obligated not to perform CPR. That same patient, if their condition hasn't changed, says, guess what, I changed my mind. I really wouldn't want CPR. Then if they're qualified to have CPR, if it's something that would be beneficial, then yes, then the CPR. So the patient has the right to revoke their own decision to not have CPR. And I think that's already covered very well in the current statute.
Further questions? We do have a slew of doctors lined up to testify, so thank you so much for being here. Good testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let's turn to Dr. Reinier. Dr. Reinier from Eagle River. Dr. Reinier, are you there?
Yes, I am.
If you would put yourself on the record and give us your testimony, please keep yourself to 3 minutes or less.
Yes, this is Dr. George Reinier. I am a cardiologist, and I'm testifying on the behalf of myself and members of the Alaska Physicians and Surgeons about this bill. Mr. Chairman, Senator Dyson and committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify about this Senate Bill 172. First of all, I'm very sympathetic with what Senator Dyson and his sponsors are trying to accomplish with this legislation, which is letting patients have more control over the treatment. After all, that's what the national trend of patient-centered care is all about. I've practiced in Alaska since 1971, and during that time I've participated probably in hundreds, if not thousands, of cardiopulmonary resuscitations. And each one was different than the other. They had different ages, diseases, the way the CPR was done, had differing outcomes, and it makes it difficult to codify or describe what you did in every circumstance. CPR was developed while I was in medical school to reverse a sudden and unexpected cessation of heartbeat and or breathing. And, of course, it wasn't designed as a technique for restarting critical organs which had slowly given out, as in the situations we've heard about. It's been successful enough to make it a standard practice for the treatment of sudden, unexpected death. Generally, it's not used when death is imminent, but the rub is, how imminent is it? This is a speculation by physicians, is viewed variably by the patients, and is pondered by families. So when to offer CPR or when to withdraw it is a decision, I think, which needs to be made by all concerned. This is particularly important since CPR isn't always successful, and often it results in more disability, pain, and suffering than was originally present. So such a discussion can result in a satisfactory outcome if all the patients are willing participants. You know, I don't drag people off the street to become my patients, and patients can't demand that I be their doctor. I believe we all agree that I can't force treatments. Likewise, medical ethics and general morality dictate that I shouldn't have to provide treatments which I deem unsafe, ineffective, harmful, or useless. So I think it's important that I discuss how to use CPR with the patient and the family in enough detail that we all are satisfied that the right thing is being done. You know, the subject of end-of-life treatments hasn't really been addressed by the legislature for 6 years, and I applaud Senator Dyson for bringing these issues forward for consideration and you committee members for thinking about it. An additional way to look at the issue is to bring a group of patients, physicians, and legislators together in a working group to discuss this issue, coming up with a way to make sure that patients are offered the treatments they properly understand and want, and that patients and physicians provide, or rather the physicians provide to their patients the information that's needed to make the decisions about the treatment that matches their own personal situation and desire. I remember one time I had a patient from Glen Allen, had a very severe heart attack. He was medevaced to Providence Hospital, and when I saw him upon arrival, it was apparent to me that he was in the process of dying, but he wanted CPR. And the reason he wanted CPR, I later found out, was that he knew that his sister was arriving from New York by plane, having heard about his serious illness, and he wanted to stay alive long enough to see her once again. She arrived some hours later. They had a very poignant reunion, and he promptly died. So I believe that the patient is always right, and the doctor should try to provide the treatment that's desired. Thank you.
Dr. Reinier, can I just ask you quickly whether or not you support this bill?
I think this bill is trying to do something that's very important, as we heard from Mrs. Mullins. But there may be better ways of doing it, and I'm not sure exactly what that might be. But I think the intent of the bill to make sure that the patient's desires are not ignored is very, very admirable.
Thank you, Doctor. Next up is Dr. Randy McGregor from Fairbanks. Dr. McGregor, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. My name is Randall McGregor, and I'm the Chief Medical Officer at Fairbanks Memorial Hospital in Fairbanks, and I'm testifying today on my own behalf and represent the views of Fairbanks Memorial. I echo Dr. Reinier's sentiments about presenting these issues, but I feel that Senate Bill 172 does not result in an improvement in every single patient's ability to choose end-of-life issues. And I broadly oppose this statute because it could compel a physician to place or revoke an order that might lead to inappropriate care or cause unnecessary harm to a patient, such as Dr. Rust alluded to. Cardiopulmonary resuscitation is done when a patient dies, a natural death in many circumstances. And it is rarely results in the patient leaving the hospital. As we heard earlier, only 17% of patients who receive cardiopulmonary resuscitation in the hospital actually survive to leave the hospital. I agree that end-of-life decisions are very important, and it is those decisions should be made with the patient's family, and with the physicians. And in the event that these decisions are not made, physicians are ethically and morally compelled to always err on the side of preserving life. This legislation would try to mandate a one-size-fits-all approach to providing this type of care, and it's very important to understand that CPR DNR order, which stands for do not resuscitate, does not equal life-sustaining measures or comfort care will be withdrawn. What a DNR order does is it allows for a natural death. And in all instances, the patient should be able to make that decision. But to compel a physician to perform a procedure like CPR when it's known that this is futile or is not consistent with the medical standards of practice, I think is the wrong approach. And I'd be happy to answer any questions in that regard.
Questions for Dr. McGregor?
I don't see any. Thank you, sir, for making time for us this afternoon.
Thank you very much to the chair and to Senator Dyson.
Dr. Ryan McGann. Dr. McGann, if you're there.
I'm here.
Please put yourself on the record, and we'll be happy to hear your testimony.
Thank you very much. My name is Ryan McGann, and I am a physician board certified in internal medicine, pulmonary disease, and critical care medicine. I practice at Providence as well as Alaska Regional Hospital and St. Elias Specialty Hospital here in Anchorage. I am calling to voice my opposition to Senate Bill 172, as well as to answer any questions about how this bill may be practiced. Clearly, you know, I went to medical school to serve patients. And, you know, in my daily practice, that is what I seek to do. I'm dismayed to hear that Mrs. Mullins had such a bad experience with her loss of her husband. Let me describe to you, if I may, how these decisions are typically made. So, you know, working in critical care, we have these conversations frequently. And we sit down with the family, and what we, the providers, bring to the table is our medical expertise and what the families, or rarely the patients themselves, are able to bring. And I say rarely because they're usually too gravely ill to participate in these conversations. What they bring is expertise in the patient and what their values are. And clearly, it is my job to honor the patient as best I can. Usually, we can find consensus. Usually, most people agree. They'd say, you know, doc, if you think you can help me, do it. And if you don't think it's going to help, don't do it. Occasionally, I'm asked to provide care, which I myself do not believe would be helpful. But, you know, I can acknowledge that other people view different situations differently, and it's my job to respect that as best I can. With any medical intervention, one has to weigh the potential benefits against the potential harms. And in this particular case, when you have a patient who is very clearly dying, when every physician involved in the care of the patient agrees that the patient is dying, when you have offered to transfer care to another physician, if another physician feels differently, when you've informed the family, I don't think it's reasonable to compel a physician against their conscience to provide care that is not capable of helping a patient, just like you wouldn't, in Dr. Olson's testimony, compel somebody to provide acupuncture, give a medication that you yourself would not advise. I really do not want to have to practice in a situation where I am forced to provide care that will offer only harm without any reasonable prospect of benefit. And I think that this will make the already difficult job of caring for critically ill and injured patients even harder. One of the biggest problems with staffing critical care units is the burnout that goes along with taking care of such ill patients. And we all want to help them, and to force us to provide care that is not going to help them is only going to make that job harder. I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Dr. McGann, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking time. We have 1, 2, 3 more people to testify. We have another bill I want to get introduced. There's a witness here who's flown to Juneau to make himself available. If the committee members can stay a few minutes over, we're going to try to wrap this up and then get that other bill introduced. Let's turn to Donna Stevens and Brian Talbot Clark from Hospice of Anchorage.
Hi. Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead and put yourself on the record.
Okay. I'm Donna Stevens. I'm a registered nurse. I have a master's in education counseling. I'm currently the executive director at Hospice of Anchorage for the past 3 years, but I volunteered with Hospice of Anchorage for 28 years. I teach adjuncts at the UAA in the psychology department, a class called Introduction to Death and Dying. And I'm here today testifying as an individual. I'd like to thank you all for having this opportunity to talk about this really important subject. I first learned about death when I was 5 years old when an uncle died in a car accident on Christmas Eve. I then had a 3-year-old cousin die from cancer when I was 12, a friend with muscular dystrophy die when I was 14, and another cousin die of cancer when I was in nursing school at 20. In nursing school, I learned how to help people recover from disease, but from my experience as a child, I've always been concerned about how we care for people who biologically cannot recover and their families. My heart went out to Mrs. Mullins as I heard her pain and her grief. That's what we here at Hospice of Anchorage try to avoid. What I've learned in my years is that most people fear what they don't know. And as a culture, we Americans avoid learning about death. And therefore, when we're faced with a life-threatening crisis, most of us do not have any knowledge of the choices we might have to face, nor do we know what's legal or ethical. Although almost, I guess everyone I meet is committed to doing the right thing, we just don't know what that right thing is. We're overwhelmed with emotional pain and fearing loss. We ask our doctors and hospitals to stop death. But when it's biologically impossible and the physicians are brave enough and take the time to tell the family or the individual that, many people react with more fear, with more pain, and sometimes with anger. I don't believe the solution to these problems in this bill. In my opinion, this bill creates many more problems than we have, and we already have plenty, and it doesn't offer real solutions. Because there's no one right way to die, the solution is in each of us learning about the benefits and burdens of some of the common choices we're apt to face, to learn about the legal and ethical issues that guide us at the end of life, and then in talking with our loved ones about what we want. I believe this is beyond legislation. Hospice of Anchorage would love to convene a coalition to talk about these issues and figure out how we can, as a society, come to some respectful ways of dialoguing about what each of us uniquely wants for our end of life. This bill, in attempting to honor the choices of the individual for care at end of life, it seems to me actually makes it harder. And so in conclusion, physicians and hospitals are programmed to cure, to save lives. And despite advanced medical care, 100% of us are still dying. It's extremely difficult for physicians and hospitals to start aggressive treatments, including resuscitating people who have died. It's the rare physician that's willing to write a DNR order, knowing that when the family has expressed a preference for this, their adherence to the ethics of good medical care should be applauded, not condemned. So we need to get on with doing the important work of helping people learn to talk about dying before they're in crisis. And I'd love to talk to any of you about what we could do to move this forward as a community, because there's more and more of us aging, and it's much more difficult with all the advances in technology for us to tell the difference between people who are living with their chronic illnesses or frailty of old age, or when they're dying from them. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
I don't see any questions. Thanks so much for coming out. Is Brian Talbot Clark there with you?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Talbot.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brian Talbot Clark, and I'm a master-level social worker with Hospice of Anchorage, testifying today on my own behalf in opposition to SB 172. In my work here and in a previous hospital internship, I've worked with numerous families on advance directives and on the importance of making their wishes known. What my experience tells me is that people don't like to talk or think about death until they have no choice. Physicians, being people too, most of them don't like to talk about it either. As I've read about the situations that prompted this bill, I do see a problem that should definitely be addressed, but it's nothing to do with the subject of this bill. The real problem is very much one of understanding and communication around end-of-life issues. I have to say it appears to me that some of that very lack of understanding and communication is reflected in the design of this legislation. A do not resuscitate order is not an advance directive. It is a statement of professional judgment that resuscitative measures will not help this patient. A patient's judgment can't make something medically indicated when it isn't. And this bill would amount to letting people require medical professionals to act unprofessionally, forcing them to give inappropriate treatment. If the patient or their power of attorney question their doctor's judgment, they can vote with their feet and get another doctor, who can readily revoke a DNR if his or her professional judgment says that that's appropriate. But a patient should no more be able to revoke their own DNR than they should be able to prescribe their own morphine. I mentioned communication. If the general public were better educated about their options, if more doctors were more willing to discuss end-of-life issues with their patients sooner, there would be a lot fewer nasty surprises like the situation that prompted this bill. That's what we should be talking about, getting the word out about what kind of choices we may have at the end of our lives, and empowering people to talk about it with their families and their doctors before an illness forces their hand. But this bill will not do any of that. As you know, the work of a legislator is very much like the work of a doctor. You must always be cautious in considering any intervention because every intervention carries the risk of harmful consequences, some known, some unforeseen. These consequences must be weighed against the expected benefit of the intervention, whether it's a medical procedure or a legislative act. The bill before you is clearly the wrong medicine. The predictable harm it will do is substantial, not even counting unforeseen consequences, while its intended effects entirely miss the mark. It will do nothing to improve communication between patients and doctors, while at the same time it stands to criminalize good medical practice and force good doctors to choose between following their ethics and obeying the law. It is not a matter of tweaking or fixing the bill. SB 172 is the wrong approach entirely and should not move forward, and I urge that the committee act accordingly. Thank you for the opportunity to speak.
Mr. Talbot Clark, thank you. The last witness we have is Dr. Mansager. Dr. Mansager, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
I'm Dr. Richard Mansager. I'm the hospital administrator of Providence, Alaska Medical Center. I'm in the somewhat awkward position of sitting right across the desk from Mrs. Mullins as we're sitting down here at the LIO, and I've been sitting here thinking for the last hour about how we failed her and her husband in communication and from her perspective in respect. I want to testify in opposition to SB 172. I think that in balance, this current statute is strikes mostly the right balance. I echo what Donna Stevens said, that this is about communication. And if from out of this experience, if we at the hospital have more to learn about communication doing better by patients, we need to do that. However, this proposed statute amendment really does something that I think is fundamentally different from the current statute, which would be to require a physician to do some treatment that is deemed futile, and there isn't any other example of that in the current statute. I think that there are current journal articles that are talk about this same ethical and legal dilemma across the country, and the articles I read most recently are coming to the conclusion that this is a area where the current statute in Alaska statute, the balance is probably about right. I think that SB 172 would change that in a way that would not be helpful as the last person just testified. So in summary, I would urge that SB 172 not move forward. Thank you.
Dr. Mansager, thank you for being brief. I appreciate that. Is there anyone else online who'd like to testify about this bill? Anyone else here in the room who'd like to testify?
that, I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony. We'll have invited testimony only after this point. And with that, we're going to set the bill aside, and so we can get SB 198 introduced. This bill has had people waiting. Thank you, Senator Dyson, for being here. We appreciate it. SB 198 is a state affairs bill. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that we've introduced through the State Affairs Committee. The idea is to try to put in place some protections for police officers. I don't know how it's late in the day. I know members have committee meetings to go to. I'm probably going to stop right there unless you or the committee have further questions. I have a staffer here to present the bill in a lot more detail, but.
You do have Jake Metcalf here, and I guess I'd like to give him the opportunity to testify. He's here in Juneau, and he's come to the Capitol like other folks have come here to try to have themselves heard in person. This bill's obviously going to get another hearing, but while Mr. Metcalf's here, why don't we invite him up and have him put himself on the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thing I'd like to mentioned to the committee is I'm here all week. I have a member who's here on his day off, and he's with the Juneau Police Department, and I don't know what his schedule is like, but if you wanted to hear from him so he could get his testimony on the record, I know he's got work schedule. I'm available at any time, so I'd be willing to let
you are here through the rest of the week.
I am.
Very good. Why don't we go ahead and turn to that officer then, and then that'll wrap it up.
That's Officer Chris Gifford from the Juneau Police Department.
Officer Gifford, please come forward. Oops. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I was going to say you look familiar, but I guess you don't look familiar. I don't think we've met. No, welcome to the Judiciary Committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Chris Gifford. I'm employed as a patrol sergeant at the Juneau Police Department, and I'm the municipal president and municipal president of the Public Safety Employees Association. I've been employed in Alaska law enforcement since 1999, and I'm a graduate of the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to voice my support for Senate Bill 198. I support Senate Bill 198 because while it might become necessary for the Alaska Police Standards Council to revoke a peace officer's law enforcement certificate, the employee facing the discipline should have the right to have his or her certificate suspended pending a decision by our courts on a termination. This would keep the disciplined officer from practicing law enforcement and away from the public in that capacity, but still afford him or her the right to be heard in front of the court. The bill does not stop the council from ultimately revoking the certificate of a proven, tarnished, or corrupt officer. It just simply makes sure that certain rights are afforded prior to doing so. It would help eliminate the possibility of a bad officer presenting a valid argument later that he or she was not afforded those rights the first time, saving us all time and money lost on a technicality. Senate Bill 198 allows police organizations to continue to use the polygraph in a pre-employment selection process. This has been proven, for the most part, to be a very useful tool in selecting only qualified candidates for law enforcement jobs. I want to make it clear that Senate Bill 198 is not intended to stop law enforcement agencies from using this tool for the selection of new officers. What it does change is allow for an officer to decline to take a polygraph in the event of an administrative investigation of possible wrongdoing by the officer. The right to decline to take a polygraph is afforded to almost everyone else in our state. Police officers are the only citizens of Alaska who can be forced to do so under the threat of termination from their job by refusal. Senate Bill 198 does not prohibit officers from volunteering to take a polygraph. It simply affords them the right to refuse. It is a right everyone else has. Police or citizens of the state should have that right. Finally, this bill would require a law enforcement agency to obtain the consent of an employee prior to releasing personal information about the employee to the public. Why is this an important aspect of Senate Bill 198? Because the department may not be aware of threats made by certain members of the public to specific officers during the course of their employment. For instance, I was involved in a death investigation in 2007. A family member of the deceased was personally involved in a campaign against me and several other members of government, trying to show how we botched what he believed to be a homicide investigation. The person posted photographs on a website dedicated to discrediting myself and other members of government. He was unable to get a photograph of me because my department did not send one to him. I appreciate that. I believe that probably most agencies in our state are already doing what this bill suggests, which is asking for authorization prior to release. This Senate Bill 198 would simply codify that standard and make it applicable to all organizations. Thank you very much for allowing me to speak today, and I'm available for questions if you have any.
Officer, I appreciate you coming on your time off. I know you work funny hours, and so this maybe you should be sleeping right now. I don't know, but I appreciate you coming.
Thank you, Senator French,
giving us the perspective of your on-the-ground views. Any questions for the officer? Don't see any. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside. We have run over a little bit, but this is a vision of what's to come, ladies and gentlemen. The Judiciary Committee has a lot of work to get done in the next couple of weeks, and so it won't be long before we're meeting in the evenings or meeting on the weekends. We will get all our work done in plenty of time, but I appreciate your sticking around for a little extra time. I look forward to more. With that, we're adjourned.